This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The possibility of collapse has finally escaped into the mainstream news. Our guest, Dmitry Orlov, predicted such extreme difficulties years ago. He added tips to soften our landing based on his experiences in the sudden fall of the Soviet Union. Dmitry, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you too, and I notice that now the business press and economists and even scientists openly talk about collapse, but what does that really mean?
Well, it basically means that the living arrangement that people have been counting on to last for their lifetimes, the lifetimes of their children and their grandchildren, is unraveling at a rate that people can no longer ignore. And it's an upsetting thing to watch, and the fact that nobody can come up with a viable alternative that can be sold is really distressing to a lot of people at all levels, not just, you know, regular people, but the elites that are supposedly in control.
Things seem paranormal. I can still go shopping in the mall. A relative is thinking of buying a new car. What makes you think a widespread collapse is coming?
Well, in terms of looking at it, there's an interesting effect. For instance, if you have a house and the foundation is falling apart, it's cracking, and there are termites in the posts and the rafters are rotted, and there's rain coming through the roof and there's a tree poking through the roof, then a building inspector can come around and condemn it. Now, you can't really do that to, you know, an industrial and military superpower. That's like walking up to a rhinoceros and telling it to roll over. It won't listen to you. And unless we see some really amazing signal events, a political unraveling, for instance, or such a severe economic crash that the economy, as we're used to thinking about it, simply evaporates, we won't really be able to say, aha, well, here's collapse. And once collapse occurs, nobody will be thinking of it in terms of anything systemic, because everything will be reduced to the level of the neighborhood or the family or the village, and people will be too busy basically scraping things together in order to survive for another day to think about big issues like where is the country going.
And is this limited to just America?
I think in other parts of the world, people are much more aware. For instance, American expats around the world, and I've been in touch with quite a few of them, have really very little trouble grasping the concept of the United States collapsing. A lot of them see it as inevitable. A lot of them are actually spending time living in other countries because they don't think that this country is such a good bet anymore. And they basically have a much easier time, a much better perspective on things. Whereas if you are living inside the United States and you depend on mass media, American mass media, to get all of your information, then you're basically buying into a fictional version of reality that doesn't correspond to what's going on either in this country or the rest of the world.
You know, every now and then I find a quote I think worth chiseling in stone, and here's one from your blog. I'm just going to read it quickly. This, then, should be the main thrust of industrial activity, to manufacture and distribute products with the understanding that this process will run out of resources and stop. These products must be designed to outlive the process by which they are made by as long as possible. Tell us about this article and why you wrote it.
Well, people sometimes think that I'm some sort of Cassandra, that I actually prognosticate because I'm one of the people who likes to do that sort of thing. And that's actually pretty far from reality because I'm just an engineer in search of meaningful employment, which turns out to be an almost impossible proposition. Because as an engineer, you work in an economy that makes throwaway items. The average useful life of a manufactured item these days is less than a year. We're just making garbage. And so what I want to do is move on from that to make things that are basically technical heirlooms that we can use for the rest of our lifetimes and pass it on to our children and their grandchildren, things that people working with hand tools and replacing parts with hand-fashioned parts can maintain perpetually, that don't really have any kind of obsolescence built into them. Now, you might think that this is impossible because everything we own, you know, it breaks and we throw it away. It turns out that that's not really the case. As an engineering, as a technological problem, it is not an unsolvable problem. It just requires a completely different mindset.
And those are the sort of products we're going to need if we even dream of having a civilization that might last for hundreds or even 1,000 years, wouldn't you say?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, for instance, there are bridges in Rome that have trucks going over them every day that were built by the Romans. They were assembled in such a way that basically there's no deterioration over time. The mortar and the quality of the carved, the cut stone was such that it'll probably last for millennia. There are lots of things like that that can be built. There are a lot of systems that can be put together, having to do with things like water supply, for instance, that can be put together in ways that will not deteriorate rapidly, do not require machinery for maintenance, and will persist. And then just about everything else we have won't really last longer than a decade.
I want to talk about another big bubble. Lots of young people are hiding out almost in universities and colleges. They're building up big student debts and hoping the job market will be better when they get out. A recent news article reports 60% of American student loans are 3 months in arrears or in outright default. Has higher education become another big Ponzi scheme?
I think it's beyond Ponzi scheme. I think that if you wanted to engineer a revolution, this is how you would go about it. You would take a whole bunch of highly educated young people and you'd deprive them of anything meaningful to do while saddling them with unrepayable debts. If you really wanted to ferment rebellion, this is the exact way to go about it, because in a few years of hanging out in their parents' basements while their loans compound, you know, into hundreds of thousands of dollars, they won't be so eager to find employment or even look for employment. They will be eager to go out and hurt whoever stole their future.
Wow. Well, on another front, I've just been arguing about capturing carbon and storing it underground. My general operating theory is this: we cannot leave storage problems for future generations because no civilization has lasted more than a few hundred years. So things like CO2 and nuclear waste have to be monitored and handled maybe for thousands of years. Doesn't your idea of collapse determine the types of technology we can use now?
Yes, it does. There are lots of things that can be done on a very local level, leaving aside, you know, really big engineering problems like nuclear waste, for instance, or carbon sequestration, which is, you know, I don't know how much of it will actually occur, but it can, certain things can be done on very local and limited bases. For instance, we can't really afford to flush human waste downstream somewhere and basically have it ferment so that it off-gases and all of the nutrients in it are lost. So all of human waste will have to be composted and returned to the soil. Add to that the fact that most of the sewage systems are unmaintainable. People won't be able to continue having sewage treatment. So the choice is really between soil depletion to a point where we can't really grow enough food, coupled with contamination so that everybody has hepatitis A at least, and cholera epidemics and things like that, that or putting things together so that human waste is composted and returned to the soil. That's just one example. Another one is, you know, there's a lot of wood and pulp and other organic materials that can be turned to charcoal and buried in the soil. And that has really good ways. Not only does it sequester carbon, but it also builds soil. And the moisture content of the soil goes up, so you can turn very sandy soil into something that can be productive. So those are the things that can be done on a very local level. Another example is you can compensate for lack of irrigation by building swales, which are basically very narrow ditches that run at a certain level along a hillside. And what they create is a freshwater lens under the surface of the ground, and they also can collect rainwater for other uses when there are heavy rains. So this is a way to compensate for lack of pumping abilities for irrigation water so that the entire system is passive and gravity driven. But to build this, you need bulldozers. So while we have the fuel to run bulldozers, we should be building swales in all of the even slightly hilly farmed areas so that we can continue using them to grow food after nitrogen fertilizer and other inputs run out.
I'm glad you brought that up. You know, one of my favorite books is by L.H. Bailey. Well, actually, it's a whole series called the Rural Science Series. They came out in the 1920s, before the days of chemical agriculture. And these books describe all the tricks of using wood stove ash, a manure, and some ground-up bones to make fertile soil instead of those fossil-based fertilizers, which are harmful to the environment and may not be available anyway. Do you see a return to some of that old knowledge?
actually, I see some return to this old knowledge because, you know, it's not obsolete. It's still useful. But I also see rapid progress to new knowledge that didn't exist back then, except in very few places, which is you can be much lazier than somebody who actually takes stuff and spreads it on the land, because you can make ecosystems that do all the work for you. So, for instance, if you need certain soil amendments, then you plant certain trees that provide the mulch to make the soil the way it needs to be. People can provide stakes, for instance, when they plant certain trees, right, because it's windy. Well, an easier way is to provide a nanny tree, a fast-growing tree that you chop down once it's done, and that's just basically to create a microclimate so you don't have to use techniques, intensive, labor-intensive techniques like that. So there's a lot of stuff that people have come up with more recently than that, just by understanding biology and soil chemistry and things like that, to figure out how to use ecosystems instead of labor.
I really like those ideas. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dmitry Orlov. Orlov was born in the former Soviet Union and educated in the United States. He's the author of Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects, published in 2008. The book suggests the Soviets were better prepared for social and economic collapse than Americans are now. Dmitry, would you talk to us a little bit about your own experiments with, well, let's just say preparations?
Well, it's more experimentation than preparations. People who tell you that they're prepared are often a little bit wrong, you know, but still what they're doing is, you know, useful. And so what I'm trying to do is to do something useful. So a few years ago, back when, you know, real estate prices, housing prices were at a peak, I realized that the biggest expenses that we have and what really ties us down is the house and the car. Those are the biggest resource expenditures that any of us have. Also the biggest energy expenditures. And so I sold our condominium and got rid of the car and bought a sailboat, a custom-made, handmade, hand-built sailboat, not a production boat. And we moved aboard and spent 2 years, a little bit less, but cruising the entire eastern seaboard of the United States from Maine to Florida, living aboard in marinas and at anchor. We spent the entire last summer at anchor. Completely off the grid. We only pulled up to the dock to take on water, and we only did that a handful of times. So it turns out that a sailboat is a remarkable test bed for testing all kinds of adaptive green technologies, because if you try to retrofit your house for these sorts of things, then basically you have to get building permits, and you have to get it has to be zoned for various uses. So if you can't just put up solar panels without seeking permission, or a big wind generator, for instance, is a no-no in a lot of communities. It has to be inspected. There has to be provisions in the code for doing this sort of thing, or you run into trouble. And then the whole property gets reappraised, so you get charged taxes for these things that are considered improvements. On a boat, you basically deal with American Boat and Yacht Council, which makes recommendations that are not really directly enforceable. And then you deal with the Coast Guard, which cares about certain safety provisions. But other than that, you're free to do anything. I mean, absolutely anything. You can craft anything you want, and provided it abides by just a few simple safety standards, you can very easily get away with it. So that's basically what I've been doing, and I built a lot of systems to make this sailboat into a survival pod, if you will. It's really quite self-sufficient at this point. I'm adding a few additional items like a wood stove, for instance, but it's generally pretty far along in that direction. And everything that I've done to it, like composting toilet technology, for instance, first of all, it has to be built to a very high standard because it's on a sailboat. And anything that's on a boat gets stressed in ways that things that go into houses do not get stressed. And secondly, it has to be very compact. And thirdly, it has to be very maintainable because you're often away from anyone who could show up and service it for you. So the things that you get to work on a sailboat are virtually guaranteed to work in settled shoreside environment. And it's all very directly transferable. So I've accumulated quite a bit of knowledge of all sorts of useful things as a result.
You've also been in a running conversation with others trying to peer into this unstable future. I'm thinking of Sharon Astix and Rob Hopkins of Transition Towns and John Michael Greer. Is collapse becoming a movement, a sort of pioneers club?
I don't think collapse itself is becoming a pioneers club, but I think that you can basically see what the problems are, regardless of collapse, and you can start addressing those problems. And I think that that's what a lot of people are interested in right now, because if there is really collapse, then all of the things we're doing right now become virtually impossible. So it makes sense to do things regardless, provided that there is a risk of collapse. It's basically based on the precautionary principle. If there is a 10% chance of everything going to hell, then you work like hell to make sure that if it does happen, you don't particularly suffer. You know, that's why people buy insurance. So really, it's just an investment in the present. It's not even an investment in the future. It's to make the present as risk-free or low risk as possible.
Can you give us a bit of a progress report on how this collapse is developing?
Yes. The thing that has occurred over the past year or year and a half is we know what peak oil looks like when it happens. People think that it has to do with long lines at gas stations or with oil shortages or with sky-high oil prices. It turns out to look a little different. Basically, it looks like people running out of money and debts going bad and the economy not growing. Because the fact is that a lot of people can't really control their energy expenditure. They have to buy the gasoline to get where they're going. They find that they don't have the money to invest in a more energy-efficient car, for instance, or to make improvements to their houses to save on heating bills, because the money for that evaporates very early on in the process. And so they're basically stuck with high, relatively high, affordable, but high energy bills. What that happens is it reduces their expenditure in all the other areas. Bills go unpaid, their mortgage lapses, they don't maintain things as well as they should, and they spend less money. And so that causes a recession, causes more jobs to be lost, causes more people to have even less money. And that has a marginal effect on energy consumption, so energy prices moderate. So what we're going to have is moderately high energy prices, not enough investment going into the energy sector, which will basically cause little price spikes here and there when supply actually does fall below demand, but gently and gradually decreasing demand over time. And at the same time, we'll have rising unemployment and we'll have a lot of debts going bad and a lot of foreclosures and a lot of business bankruptcies. So that's basically what the plateau looks like. It was called a plateau a while ago, and there was a massive price spike, and now we have stubbornly high prices, and relatively high. And the whole thing seems to be stable, but very slowly unwinding. So more and more debts go bad. Before it was banks, now it's whole countries going bad. And there are no extraterrestrials that will come down and bail us out. So once big countries start going broke, then, you know, that's it for the financial collapse. That will have run its course. Now, overlapping with it is a commercial collapse where businesses can no longer function at the scale they're used to. You know, the canaries in the coal mine are the little mom-and-pop businesses, little hardware stores, things like that. A lot of them have closed. Small business is really suffering. Big box stores have more of a financial reserve. A lot of people consider them too big to fail. A lot of them get some kind of a bailout arrangement for the time being. But when those start failing, then that's probably the last thing for a lot of communities. A lot of communities, if you close the Walmart, then they have to drive very long distances in order to get what they need. So that will be pretty far along in the commercial collapse. Political collapse, it's just starting up. Now, there isn't really a lot of hope for the political process. I mean, if you look at, you know, the people participating in it, like Sarah Palin, for instance, not the sharpest knife in the drawer, or the guy who got elected in Massachusetts, where I am right now, Todd Brown, basically a bunch of people in Western Mass, which is not where Boston is, thought that they could elect him to Congress so that their state taxes would go down. They don't really realize that Congress doesn't vote on state taxes. So that's the kind of brilliance that you can expect from the electorate, but they're very, very irate, and they will basically vote for all kinds of strange people, basically to punish their politicians for no other reason. And the question is, how long can that go on before it's clear that nothing useful can happen? What I've observed in Russia is a lot of talk and just general paralysis before the final political collapse occurred. But once it started, political collapse can be very sudden, can be very abrupt, because everybody gives up at the same time. And it's unclear when it'll happen, but there's a likelihood that it will.
I think a lot of people have given up or are in the process of doing it, and we certainly see paralysis in Washington these days. We're going to have to wrap it up at this point, Dimitri, but I wanted to give you a chance to tell us about your new limited edition book of essays that you've got going.
Well, first of all, I started working on the next book, the big next book, which is The Five Stages of Collapse, based on articles I've already written and talks I've given at conferences, and it's a very popular subject. People are very interested in this taxonomy of collapse, understanding how the various pieces interrelate in a collapse scenario. So I really want to be working on that book, but to raise funds for it, I decided to come up with a limited edition book of essays that basically my wife and I are not even so much selling. We're accepting donations, and then people who donate via my blog get this numbered, autographed, limited edition book of essays that we basically put in an envelope by hand, put stamps on the envelope, address the envelope, and send to them. And it's quite a bit of work because it's hundreds of copies. But we're just basically doing this extreme kind of organic self-publishing model, and it's working out remarkably well. It's a nice little book. It's very nicely designed, and I think people will really like it, and it gives them just something tangible to hold on to and share with other people. They're giving me a donation, and in return, I give them a gift.
Our guest has been Dimitri Orlov. Find his blog at cluborlov.blogspot.com, and his name is spelled O-R-L-O-V. I have ordered Dimitri's new collection of essays called Hold Your Applause, and Dimitri, I promise, if the power goes out, your essays will be the last book I burn to keep warm. Thanks so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock today.
Thank you.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.